I'm Deborah Shapiro, and your host for Cooks and Books on the Heritage Radio Network. And our sponsor today is Whole Foods Market, and you can find them all over the country. So Whole Foods is sponsoring us today. And I always like to start the show with some music that represents my guest. And today my guest is Chef Eric Warnstedt, and you're going to hear a lot from him and about him. Now, at the moment, he's the chef and owner of Hen of the Wood, which he opened in 2005. He was born in Fort Lauderdale, and he's about 34 years old. He's accomplished quite a bit. He went to Johnson & Wales. He's had a lot of exciting work experience. He's been at Wildwood in Portland, Oregon, at the Peaks Resort in Telluride, the River House in Grassy Creek, North Carolina, in the Vermont area. He's cooked at Smoked Jack's and Shelburne Farms and the Kitchen Table, and then opened his own place about 4.5 years ago. You may have heard of Chef Eric Warnstedt because Food & Wine named him one of the top 10 chefs in 2008. Gourmet has named his restaurant one of the top 100 farm-to-table restaurants. Recently, Bon Appetit named them the top romantic, one of the top romantic restaurants, and he's been getting a lot of press and exposure. And another reason I have him on with me today is that 2 weeks from tonight, he'll be cooking with Team Vermont at the James Beard House in New York, and he's also been nominated for a regional James Beard Award. So welcome, Chef.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We just heard Exodus by Bob Marley, so that's something that you said we might hear when you're cooking in the kitchen.
We have a pretty large iPod on random all day long, so there's lots of Bob Marley, Rolling Stones, The Dead, all that kind of stuff.
And that's one way you keep your energy up and going.
We do, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what brought you to food, because I think when someone's as accomplished as you are, it's always fun to hear about what got them there. So
sure.
What's one of your earliest food memories or inspirations?
The backstory to cooking isn't as glamorous as a lot of other chefs, I think. I grew up in a good food home. My mom cooked every night. We had family dinner every night. It was far from a foodie community, but we did eat really good seafood, and stone crabs are always a big deal when they came in season, good steaks and things like that. But in terms of high-end dining, we didn't really do much of that. But in college, I started working for a restaurant just for extra money. And it was the two chefs were the two owners, and they were pretty young and pretty hip, and it was a pretty unique spot for the town I went to college in. And it seemed like if they could do it, it seemed like a lot of fun, even though they were working really hard, and my degree in college could sort of translate into some kind of business ownership role. So it seemed like the next progression would be to finish college, go to culinary school, and you know, really put my head down and focus on it. In terms of college, it was a little bit more of an enjoyable 4 years than an extremely academic 4 years. So I was feeling a little bit of pressure about what exactly what road I was going to take, and the cooking seemed to, once I thought that's what I was going to do, it was, you know, head down and, you know, worked extremely hard for the next 10 years or so.
So what did you study?
I have a business degree with a management
concentration. Oh, that must come in handy.
Yeah, it does at times. You know, there's certain things I reference, but I think just having my head in the game that was going to be the idea eventually of a business ownership, I think, was what caused me to have that degree originally. So it did eventually fall into place.
And then how did you pick Johnson & Wales?
At the time, I think back then, that was about 10 or 12, 13 years ago, the CIA required a little bit more work experience than I had had. One of the Johnson & Wales campuses was back at home where I grew up.
Oh.
So I was able, after college, I moved back home for that period of time.
Uh-huh.
And I did sort of an advanced degree. Since I already had a bachelor's degree, I was able to skip a lot of the basic college courses and do just straight culinary. So it was a pretty quick 12 months. It was 8 months in school and then 4 months or 5 months on internship. So it was sort of a blink of an eye. I was in and out of there as fast as I possibly could, to be honest. Yeah.
And so what really appealed to you when you were cooking for those two guys? And
something just connected on an environmental level, a sustainability level, a profitability level. It seemed like you could sort of have everything all at once by being in the food world, as opposed to, say, going for some larger corporate place where you might make enough money to live the kind of life you'd imagine. The restaurant world seemed like it could have the professional side of things being in some kind of sustainable world. The personal side of things could be in some kind of sustainable world, and yet you could also make a decent living, hopefully, if you did it right. So it seemed to be a logical progression. Even though food was an enormous part of my culture growing up, it seemed like for some reason it seemed normal at the time. And at that period of time, I was in North Carolina, and there was a lot of really great environmental resources there in terms of backpacking and hiking and all that kind of stuff. So all that sort of fell into play with a different level of respect for the environment and sustainability and wanting to focus on that and learn more about it. So at that time, all the cookbooks I was reading were obviously like the Chez Panisse books, and even things like the Innit Little Washington. That cookbook is really beautifully photographed, and it has a feeling of farm-to-table, even if it really wasn't as much farm-to-table as it would have you imagine. It had sort of that vibe of something in the country that was able to produce a handful of things themselves. They had a lot of relationships with smaller rural farmers. The environment there was really similar to where I was in North Carolina, and it sort of spurred that idea of, oh, a small place in a somewhat rural setting where you can connect with all these local people and create a menu based on daily inspiration. And at Hen of the Wood, I feel like we actually do that, and that's what's helped us be successful. A lot of places discuss that idea, but don't necessarily pull it off all the time because they're either too big or they have too many employees, and you can't simply say, okay, guys, go nuts every day, and hopefully it works. You know, we're small enough, there's just a couple of us that we can say, okay, today, tomorrow, the next day, we have this, this, and this. And it works out. We reprint the menu every day, and we don't stray too far from our sort of standard way of cooking, but it's a little different every single day. If we have enough short ribs to have them every single day, 365 days a year, then we'll have short ribs on the menu.
Well, let's go back a little, because maybe we could talk a little bit about, it sounds like the farm-to-table ethic was established early for you. Right? So how do you express that or manifest that at Hen of the Wood? Like, give us a little idea of what it's like. So it's, you know, the beginning of a week, and you have to do some marketing, so to speak. How do you go about doing that?
Well, we have our email updates from our different farmers, and usually there's a rash of phone calls at the beginning of the week about who has what or a handful of emails, and we just get it started. It's really that simple. And now we've been around for a couple of years. It's not as fly-by-the-seat as it used to be, but it still is pretty loose in terms of someone will call and say, oh, we have this many extra lamb shoulders. Do you want them? Or we have one pig head. Would you like it to play with? Things like that. So we've been able to play a lot more than I think other restaurants can. But we have to keep things really simple, too, because it's so small and only a couple employees. We can't really do all this really wild, elaborate stuff with whole cuts of an animal because we just don't simply have that kind of time or manpower. So the idea is if you're going to do it the way we do it, with so small, it needs to be really simple.
So let's share with folks who may not be fortunate enough to get to Waterbury, Vermont, a little bit about the restaurant. So it's located in an incredible setting. You've got that beautiful waterfall that people see. It's how many seats?
It's 40 seats. It's in a converted grist mill that was originally built in the 1830s, had some minor work done in the 1850s. I think the stamp on the building now says 1835 or 1845. But all the structure in the restaurant is all original, the stone walls, the posts and beams, the back wall that has the glass overlooking, our windows overlooking the waterfall, that's new. That's a newer addition within the past 50 years. But the rest of the structure is, you know, almost 200 years old or so, and it's a really unique, special building, and I think it really complements the food, and the food complements the building.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't be a good restaurant for a sushi bar. You know, it would feel awkward to be in there. So the goal was, when we found that place, you know, the idea had always been this kind of, you know, historic setting, visually appealing,
unique little open kitchen.
And we found all that with this space. And luckily, it had been a previous restaurant before. So being, we were 29 when we opened it, with obviously not a lot of money. So luckily, the place was sort of set up. The money that we did raise for it, we spent on nice crystal and nice flatware and things to sort of make it a little bit more of a high-end dining destination than maybe it was before.
And when you say we,
I have a business partner, Craig Tresser. He's pulled away a little bit from the restaurant, but he's still a co-owner of the place. So he and I were together 6 days a week for the first 3 years. All day and night, and but he's pulled away a little bit. He got a little bit more normal job for now. It was a little much for him.
Well, I do want to talk to you a little bit, too, about the front of the house, because, I mean, you know, and I also want to hear a little more about where the food, let's talk a little more about just a dish first, though.
Okay.
I mean, sort of, so, you know, you hear about that lamb shoulder, and then how does the dish develop? Like, how do you
I think
put all that together?
If you're someone who's, I don't always like the term foodie, but if you're a foodie and you were handed a lamb shoulder, there's probably a handful of things you would maybe think of off the top of your head that might go with lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's say, like, green olives or black olives and feta cheese, maybe,
mm-hmm.
Braised, probably. Some simple preparation, gremolata, parsley, lemon.
Mm-hmm.
All those sort of basic components that somewhere you know in your head are traditional and have all been over the past, 150 years, have been established as how to cook a piece of lamb.
Uh-huh.
I think that's sort of how we do things at the restaurant. Nothing is really that unique and different. I think it's just done properly, and it's done with really, really, really great ingredients. So,
uh-huh.
like for us to braise a piece of lamb shoulder and some decent wine and lamb stock and then pull the meat and toss it with green olives, feta, and some gnocchi that we make at the restaurant, it's simple as can be, but it's seasoned properly and it's braised properly, and the gnocchi is delicious, and when you put it all together, it's sort of, you can't really argue with it. You can't say, oh, this is too boring or this is too basic, because it is a solid dish, and it comes from right down the street, and it's put together by either the owner of the place or the next guy step below
mm-hmm.
the owner, and it's sort of hard to argue with, I feel like. I don't know if that
mm-hmm.
sounds arrogant, but I feel like that's sort of the way we do it. That's why we've been successful, because
mm-hmm.
it is pretty simple, and the idea is more of the ethic sort of driving the restaurant, and some solid cooking techniques right behind that ethic.
So what would you say is the signature? Because, what would you say is the signature dish of Hen of the Wood, and how would that sort of evolve?
To answer how it would evolve, I'm not sure if I can answer that, to be honest. Like, the short ribs are a good dish. It would say it would
right.
be a signature dish, I guess, because we have them regularly, and it's delicious meat, and the setup is pretty simple, but it's done properly. So that sort of has become something that's on the menu all the time, too, most
mm-hmm.
of the time. So that maybe that makes it a little bit more of a signature. The menu is reprinted most of the every day, but it doesn't always. But sometimes the short ribs will be on for a couple of weeks at a time. If
always
longer.
Prepared the same, or
minor changes, depending on the season. But
mm-hmm.
We'll have heavy braised short ribs in the middle of the summer if we have access to them,
because mm-hmm.
we sort of need to buy whatever we can to keep the menu large enough
mm-hmm.
to be sort of normal. We're not in a city where I think we can get away with having a really small menu and people might understand that.
Uh-huh.
I feel like our menu is still pretty user-friendly
uh-huh.
to a lot of average non-food people,
uh-huh.
people that are traveling up here and maybe aren't necessarily coming to Hen of the Wood because we're some foodie place. They're just coming to a restaurant. I don't think it would really scare anyone away by anything
uh-huh.
weird. There might be a couple awkward things on the menu, but there's also like a steak and potato vibe on certain dishes as well that I think are pretty
uh-huh.
user friendly.
So, and what I'm just curious, what
sorry
are the
if
biggest
I'm bouncing
sellers?
All over the place.
No, that's where the conversation is. What are the biggest sellers? I'm just curious.
Anything with
Hen
of the Wood,
I guess,
is a big.
Hen of the Wood
mushrooms is a pretty big seller. We always have some sort of appetizer. When we first opened, we only sold wild Hen of the Woods. Then we started buying cultivated maitakes so
uh-huh.
we could have them on year round. It just seemed. Right,
and are those local also? Is there
they're
someone
not.
Near? No,
no, we haven't found
defined.
Anybody up here that does that yet, which I'm surprised. I feel like there'd be a pretty good market for that. There's
uh-huh.
a lot of shiitake growers and some oyster mushroom growers up here, but we haven't found anyone doing maitake.
How far yet. Do you have to go? Oregon?
We have a couple different distributors that get them for us, but these are actually grown in California.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So anyone listening who's in the East Coast area
yeah.
who wants a neat business,
or if you have them growing.
Give Hen of the Wood a call. We'll make sure you know how to find them.
So the signature thing, though, LaBelle Farms duck breast, it became something Food & Wine did in 2007. They named it as one of their top 10 dishes of the year, which I'm not sure how they found that. But so the duck with mustard spetzel was on. So we almost, that's a little bit larger supplier, LaBelle Farms. We can access that meat almost year-round. So even though duck isn't something that you would imagine being on year-round, it's a dish that we usually have,
uh-huh.
9 out of 10 nights. That would be the first one, actually, and then the short ribs would maybe fall a little bit second because the short ribs come and go. But we don't have as much of a steady supply of the short ribs as we do the duck. So the duck would be a signature dish, I guess, if we had
uh-huh.
to say. I would like to say, though, that I sort of discourage that idea at the restaurant of our signature dish. We have
uh-huh.
gotten into a groove the past year or two about what works in our little space. Our kitchen is pretty old and pretty antiquated, so we have streamlined some things, and now we sort of know what we're doing back there. So
uh-huh.
I think it feels a little bit more, the change might not be as as easy to see, even though little things change every day. It's not major changes. We sort of have our bag of tricks that we sort of sort of move across certain dishes. So setups change, you know, minorly. Little things move around here and there. This time of year, it gets a little bit more boring. You know, we can only mix up different kinds of turnips and potatoes and onions so many ways. I'm actually okay with the winter pantry. I feel like we've done pretty well with it, especially one of our farmers is a pretty big four-season farmer. When it comes to turnips, carrots, all that kind of stuff, it's every different size, every different color, every different variety. So for myself, it's actually exciting. I don't find it too boring, but we have had some people that say, you know, maybe you guys could go outside the box a little bit and bring in some more things from out of the region, which there are. You know, we have lemons and Meyer lemons and citrus.
Right.
And it's not like we're only creating a couple dishes based on what we can do. We are still a restaurant like anywhere else where we have to use some basic staples to keep the menu rolling. But we're doing it as much as we possibly can from this region.
Well, and that, I think, is the interesting thing about an ethic, you know, is where do you start to, it's one thing to sort of say, okay, lemons, they're not growing in New England anywhere that I know of,
right.
But then there's other things where I could see you wanting to stick with it, you know, and now, and what I was thinking of, I can appreciate you're not wanting to get pigeonholed into a signature dish, but there's that incredible appetizer you make, isn't it, bacon and honey and
With the blue cheese
blue
drizzle.
Cheese and,
yeah, that's always something that we've, like, sent
that.
It out to people as, like, a little bite.
Yeah.
It's never been on the menu, I don't think, but it's, like, a little amuse or something. It's some grilled bread, Red Hen bread with local blue cheese, some house-cured bacon.
Yeah, it's really wonderful.
And just drizzled with wildflower honey.
And that whole amuse bouche that you talked about, I mean, let's talk a little about the front of the house, because, you know, there's a feeling that has to go on in a restaurant, and I think that it's nice when the food matches what goes on in the front, right? I mean, if you don't get a warm greeting, I don't care how great it tastes, you don't ever feel. So how do you keep all that together? You know, what leadership style do you have to sort of keep it all going?
Gosh, blind faith, to be honest. We have a great staff. We have a really mature staff. I mean, mistakes happen like they happen anywhere, but most of the people that work at Heatherwood in the front of the house, they're not younger, inexperienced servers. They're professional servers that probably, you know, make a legitimate salary and do really well for themselves, especially working, you know, usually 4 days a week. So they've been there and done that at a couple other restaurants by now. And I think once they buy into what we're doing, they are actually pretty proud to show it off. So I think that comes through. That comes through more than learning the steps of service or techniques of a server, how to properly open a bottle of wine, things like that. I think if you have some pride as a server in the place that you work, it shows through, and you can discuss the food with the customer. You can discuss on a friendly level, as opposed to anything condescending or arrogant or talking down to someone about food and wine. There's a way that you can discuss it that's gently knowledgeable, without trying to teach people anything. Just simply open discussion about food and wine. So I think that's what's really helped. My manager is outstanding.
And what makes an outstanding manager?
He bought into the whole concept, and he's doing his best to learn as much as he can about food and wine. He's actually started taking his Master Sommelier's test. He's taken the first one, which it's a long road, but it just shows he's in this for the long haul. And he has a huge dedication to Hen of the Wood, and hopefully he'll be with us for a long time if we grow or move into other locations, or should we ever do anything else. He's sort of part of the main fold. So I think when it comes to that kind of feeling in the restaurant, they already, like I said, they already know the technique of being a good server, and then it's down to pride and sort of taking some ownership.
And sort of wanting to get behind the scenes a little. So, you know, we know that you're very busy, right? We were just talking a little earlier about how on a Saturday night with only 40 seats, if you want to come in at 7 o'clock, you might have to wait a month. So I would imagine that a great manager knows a little bit about how to keep people wanting to come either earlier or later.
We try. We do our best. We don't have a bar either, which has been a big challenge. So reservations need to be pretty organized, and we have to give tables a little bit longer than maybe we would. If we had a little bit larger restaurant with a bar where you could simply say, your table's not available yet, please come at the bar, which happens almost everywhere on a busy weekend night.
Right.
So we have to, if you've been to Hen of the Wood, there's not that much space to hang out and wait. So he does his best to keep the book really organized and try to ask people, you know, if they can come in a little earlier, a little bit later. Most people are very kind. some people aren't.
Well, what would we want to say to folks who are listening about that? You know, just sort of from your perspective.
From my perspective, it would be to come in earlier in the week, and you can probably get in whenever you need to.
Mm-hmm.
If so it's during really high time, you might not be able to call that day, but a day or two in advance on Tuesday or Wednesday is usually all you need.
So often, for a lot of favorite restaurants, if people could just have a little flexibility sometime, that
might
help them out a little bit. So when you're not in the restaurant, because you have a lovely little girl and a partner, and what do you cook at home? What do you find inspires you at home, or do you cook at home?
I cook at home, but I cook really, really simple at home. You know, like my favorite kind of food would be like a hanger steak with arugula, olive oil, and lemon. Maybe some shaved hard cheese on it or something. That's it. You know, something really, really simple, really quick. I go out to eat a lot as well. We have a lot of trade accounts with the local restaurants, so they can come to my place and vice versa. And so we do that quite a bit, to be honest.
That's a great way of doing it.
Yeah, it's outstanding.
Be nice if we could figure out how all of us could do that.
Yeah.
A little dine-around guide. What are some of the cookbooks? You had said that you were reading Chez Panisse and some of those early on. What are some of the things that inspire you now, some of the authors and out there?
I guess it's a little cliche now with most cooks, but like the Au Pair de Cochon, Martin Picard, that kind of just sort of, I don't know, sort of burly, a little bit in your face with food, and it drops all the pretentiousness about it. It probably breaks down all the walls of what fine dining was and now what it can be, which is simply just eating good food in a fun environment. There's no reason that it has to be so tight and formal. It seems like in most cities now that there's all these great restaurants that are extremely casual. They have young owners and young management, and they're all just hungry to learn about food and wine, but drop the sort of some of the pretentiousness that comes with other high-end dining, which I think is really outstanding, because that's really what we're looking for. Kind of the wood has become more formal just because we've become so busy. It might feel like it's more of a high-end special occasion place, but it really was never supposed to be. It was supposed to be the service and the food should be spot on, but the vibe in there was supposed to be casual and shouldn't feel like you can only come out to dinner there on an anniversary or something like that.
And you think that's an interesting insight, though, for us and for the listeners, that sometimes that happens just because you have to tighten it up a bit, you know, so there's
I think expectations get built up, too. Couple magazine articles and some glossy pictures, and certain people that maybe don't dine out a lot have a different image of what a restaurant that may be in Food & Wine magazine is supposed to be, and all kinds of restaurants can be in these nice food magazines. We are a high-end restaurant because we're expensive. That's because we have all local organic and such. But it's far from a kind of place where you sit and have 10 courses and it's very tight and formal. It's very, very far from that. You can come in and feast and hang out and get loud, or you can come in and have a nice, quiet, romantic.
You did just comment on, you know, so it's expensive because of the local ingredients. So just take a minute to tell us a little about why that's. I mean, we don't have to get into a whole political discussion. I think most of the folks listening to the show, they know that we're on the Heritage Radio Network. Heritage has done an incredible job of bringing back heritage breeds and wonderful food. But if you could just share a little bit of what it means to source locally and why that has to get transferred on to the diner a little bit.
We're a small place. Not having a bar is a big challenge in terms of being profitable. So food cost is pretty. It's a normal calculation like any other restaurant, and actually we usually knock it down a little bit because we do serve a lot of premium cuts, like you know, lamb loin or venison loin or ribeye, as opposed to always having the lamb shoulders and that kind of product. So those are extremely, extremely expensive, and that means there's fewer ingredients on the plate, and we have to make enough money to survive, which is extremely challenging. Running a small business is hard enough. Running a small restaurant is extremely challenging. It's very hard to be profitable. So we do our best to not put prices too high, but we're trying to become more comfortable with just charging what we need to. When we first opened, I feel like the prices were really low, just because I personally felt uncomfortable about charging so much, because that was never really the goal. But if you want a Vermont-grown grass-fed ribeye,
There's only so many to go around.
Yeah, it costs a lot of money. Or some local venison loin, it's extremely expensive. You know, we're talking like
right.
$16, $17 a pound, things like that.
Right.
So when you break that down and put it on a plate and add a couple other ingredients to it,
right.
And so, you know, it's a $30 plate all of a sudden, which is a little hard to swallow. I don't like even putting that stuff on the menu. It's just,
mm-hmm.
but if we have access to it, we're going to buy it, and hopefully people get. Some
mm-hmm.
nights, actually, not to get off topic too much, but some nights the menu is really expensive,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we have all these premium cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And other nights, it's in the mid and lower 20s because we have more of the lamb shoulder
mm-hmm.
and the random this or that. Made up of the majority of the menu, so
right.
it's really it could one night at Hand of the Wood can be completely different than another.
Well, and what's interesting about that is you know I think traditionally you'd go out somewhere, you'd have a menu, and you might have one or two specials. But mm. your menu is completely the opposite.
Mm.
Everything on it's a special, and then it reflects you know the market price is really what you're reflecting based
sure.
on how you design that menu.
We're trying to take a snapshot of that particular week or so in this region. That's sort of the goal. You know,
that's a neat way of looking
of
at
week,
it,
sort of.
Uh-huh. Of what's in season, what's available.
Mm.
That's a really
you had mentioned
way of
earlier other inspirations. I don't think we went too far on that. I mentioned
yeah.
like the Martin Picard and those guys.
Right.
Gosh, I can't. There's lately, it's been just seeing new restaurants pop up and seeing all this sort of new young energy. Hugh Fernley Whittingstall,
yeah,
that whole thing going on over there is like our, you know, guys that cook like myself, I think that's sort of
mm-hmm.
some kind of mecca over there.
Mm-hmm.
He's some kind of little messiah hanging out over there in his little
The farm. River Cottage.
The River Cottage, yeah.
Yeah, that's the book you're talking about.
So that stuff is really inspiring to see it all sort of put together in one space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dan Barber and all those guys, the whole Stone Barns thing and Blue Hill, that's really inspirational. I think we've had some people that have worked for those guys and I think have brought back some experience. Just servers, but it brought back a certain vibe of those
mm-hmm.
restaurants.
I mean, you're not sitting there reading cookbooks at night for
No, I used to. That's all I would do every morning. I would grab the dog, walk to get coffee, and sit down with a notebook and a cookbook and just, like, slip through them constantly.
Huh.
Like, literally, constantly. And I feel like all of a sudden one day certain things just stuck, and there was sort of this, for lack of a better word, style in my
mm-hmm.
head of how I thought food
mm-hmm.
should be, or what I could do myself, what I could accomplish. And it was a handful of books, I think, that we looked at so many times that they just became sort of ingrained in there. Like, recipes
mm-hmm.
were really unnecessary, but just a vibe of a cookbook. Like,
mm-hmm.
the Wildwood cookbook has a certain feeling to it, and you
right.
can translate that into the food. The Zuni Cafe cookbook was another
mm-hmm.
another really big inspirational
yeah.
one. I feel like that was just sort of around and constantly flipping through it. And when you read about taking care of certain ingredients and working with a personal farmer, and you start that connection becomes pretty tight. The last thing you want to do is put 12 other ingredients on the plate
mm-hmm.
and sort of strip it down to nothing. You want to just have that single ingredient on a plate if you could. You know, if we
right.
could get away with that, we probably would. You know, if we had baby
mm-hmm.
fennel, and I could say, oh, look how cool this baby fennel is, we could shave it thin and just drizzle it with olive oil and lemon and put it out, we probably would do that. We're not at that point with Hen of the Wood.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be the ultimate goal, to be as simple as can be.
Might be a fun idea for a dinner, though. You know, might
yeah.
be a fun idea to either, because I know you did your, was it Monday or Tuesday night, you did your blackboard
yeah,
special?
It was Monday night. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
chalkboard
it might be fun
Monday.
To do a simple, the simpler the better menu
yeah.
or something, and
especially
try to get
in the
people
summertime.
In. Be really fun. One thing I want to make sure we talk about before we close is the Team Vermont dinner coming up at the James Beard House. So on Monday, March 22nd, you and six other chefs from the wonderful state of Vermont
yes.
are going to be cooking a great dinner. So if you could tell us a little bit just about how that came about
sure,
and
it was,
what you're going to cook for that night.
It was put together by Mark Timms up at Top Notch Resort.
Mm-hmm.
He gathered a handful of us and used the help of the PR team, I guess, at Top Notch to sort of get the ball rolling with all of this. You know, a place like Hen of the Wood, we're a little small and a little underfunded to sort of take a lot of time to organize like this. Mark did a great job of really getting everyone together, getting everyone excited, coming up with a general format about, you know, you're going to do an appetizer, you're going to do an entree,
mm-hmm.
yada, yada. And it happened really quick, and they set it all up for this great dinner down at the James Beard House. So Team Vermont will be myself, Solstice Resort or Solstice Restaurant,
right.
Norma's Restaurant, the Bluebird Tavern, Verde, and the Kitchen Table Bistro, and Hen of the Wood. And we'll all go down, do a course, and sort of hopefully showcase what great resources we have in Vermont.
Well, we'll hear more about that, too, in our next half of the show. So that's it for today. Thanks very much for listening. And there's a lot more to hear from Chef Eric Warnstedt, so we're going to bring him back for our show on March 22nd. And our sponsor has been Whole Foods Market. You're listening to Cooks and Books on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Deborah Shapiro, and thanks so much for joining us.